For the first time in several days, he allowed himself to think of Drool and Lord Fowl. He knew that either of them was capable of killing away in him, even of killing it gratuitously. And the despiser, at least, might easily know where he was. But the day passed without mishap. The dim, constant uneasiness in the air grew no worse, and Aliantha abounded. As the leagues passed, Covenant's anger lost its edge. He relaxed into contemplation of the health around him, looked with undiminished wonder at the trees, the magisterial oaks and dignified elms, the comforting spread of the guilden, the fine filigree of the mimosas, the spry saplings of wattle, and at the calm old contours of the hills, lying like slumberous heads to the reclining earth of the western plains. Such things gave him a new sense of the pulse and pause, the climbing sap and the still rock of the land. In contrast, the trailing ordure of death seemed both petty, insignificant beside the vast, abundant vitality of the hills, and vile, like an act of cruelty done to a child. The next morning, Atiaran changed her course, veering somewhat eastward, so that she and Covenant climbed more and more into the heart of the hills. They took a crooked trail, keeping primarily to valleys that wandered generally northward between the hills. And when the sun was low enough to cast the eastern hillsides into shadow, the travelers came in sight of Soaring Woodhelven. Their approach gave Covenant a good view of the tree village from some distance away across a wide glade. He judged the tree to be nearly 400 feet high and a good 30 broad at the base. There were no branches on the trunk until 40 or 50 feet above the ground. Then abruptly, huge limbs spread out horizontally from the stem, forming in outline a half oval with a flattened tip. The whole tree was so thickly branched and leaved that most of the village was hidden, but Covenant could see a few ladders between the branches and along the trunk, and in some tight knots on the limbs he thought he could make out the shapes of dwellings. If any people were moving through the foliage, they were so well camouflaged that he could not discern them. "That is Soaring Woodhelven," said Atiaran, "a home for the people of the Lilianril, as Mithilstone Down is a home for those of the Rodamarl. I have been here once, on my returning from the Lorsrot. The Woodhelvenin are a comely folk, though I do not understand their wood lore. They will give us rest and food, and perhaps help as well. It is said, go to the Rodamarl for truth, and the Lilianril for counsel. My need for counsel is sore upon me. Come." She led Covenant across the glade to the base of the great tree. They had to pass around the rough, barked trunk to the northwest curve, and there they found a large natural opening in the hollow stem. The inner cavity was not deep. It was only large enough to hold a spiral stairway. Above the first thick limb was another opening, from which ladders began their way upward. The sight gave Covenant a quiver of his old fear of heights, almost forgotten since his ordeal on the stairs of Kevin's watch. He did not want to have to climb those ladders. But it appeared that he would not have to climb. The opening to the trunk was barred with a heavy wooden gate, and there was no one to open it. In fact, the whole place seemed too quiet and dark for a human habitation. Dusk was gathering, but no home glimmers broke through the overhanging shadow, and no gloaming calls between families interrupted the silence. Covenant glanced at Atiaran and saw that she was puzzled. Resting her hands on the bars of the gate, she said, "This is not well, Thomas Covenant. When last I came here, there were children in the glade, people on the stair, and no gate at the door. Something is amiss. And yet I sense no great evil. There is no more ill here than elsewhere along our path." Stepping back from the gate, she raised her head and called, "Hail, Soaring Woodhelven! We are travelers, people of the land. Our way is long, our future dark. What has become of you?" When no answering shout came, she went on in exasperation, I have been here before. In those days, it was said that Woodhelven in hospitality had no equal. Is this your friendship to the land? Suddenly, they heard a light scattering fall behind them. Spinning around, they found themselves encircled by 7 or 8 men gripping smooth wooden daggers. Instinctively, Atiaran and Covenant backed away. As the men advanced, one of them said, "The meaning of friendship changes with the times. We have seen darkness and heard dark tidings. We will be sure of strangers." A torch flared in the hands of the man who had spoken. Through the glare, Covenant got his first look at the Woodhelvenin. They were all tall, slim and lithe, with fair hair and light eyes. They dressed in cloaks of woodland colors, and the fabric seemed to cling to their limbs, as if to avoid snagging on branches. Each man held a pointed dagger of polished wood, which gleamed dully in the torchlight. Covenant was at a loss, but Atiaran gathered her robe about her and answered with stern pride, "Then be sure. I am Atiaran, trail mate of Mithil Stonedown. This is Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and message-bearer to the lords. We come in friendship and need, seeking safety and help. I did not know that it is your custom to make strangers prisoner." The man who held the torch stepped forward and bowed seriously. "When we are sure, we will ask your pardon. Until that time, you must come with me to a place where you may be examined. We have seen strange tokens, and see more now." He nodded at Covenant. "We would make no mistake, either in trust or in doubt. Will you accompany me?" "Very well," Atiaran sighed. "But you would not be treated so in Mithil Stonedown." The man replied, "Let the Stonedowners taste our troubles before they despise our caution. Now, come behind me." He moved forward to open the gate. At the command, Covenant balked. He was not prepared to go climbing around a tall tree in the dark. It would have been bad enough in the light when he could have seen what he was doing, but the very thought of taking the risk at night made his pulse hammer in his forehead. Stepping away from Atiaran, he said with a quaver he could not repress, "Forget it." Before he could react, 2 of the men grabbed his arms. He tried to twist away, but they held him, pulled his hands up into the torchlight. For one stark moment, the Woodhelvenin stared at his hands, at the ring on his left and the scar on his right, as if he were some kind of ghoul. Then the man with the torch snapped, "Bring him." "No," Covenant clamored. "You don't understand. I'm not good at heights. I'll fall." As they wrestled him toward the gate, he shouted, "Hellfire, you're trying to kill me." His captors halted momentarily. He heard a series of shouts, but in his confused, angry panic, he did not understand. Then the leader said, "If you do not climb well, you will not be asked to climb." The next moment, the end of a rope fell beside Covenant. Instantly, 2 more men lashed his wrists to the line. Before he realized what was happening, the rope sprang taut. He was hauled into the air like a sack of miscellaneous helplessness. He thought he heard a shout of protest from Atiaran, but he could not be sure. Crying silently, "Bloody hell," he tensed his shoulders against the strain and stared wildly up into the darkness. He could not see anyone drawing up the rope. In the last glimmering of the torch, the line seemed to stretch up into an abyss, and that made him doubly afraid. Then the light below him vanished. The next moment, a low rustling of leaves told him that he had reached the level of the first branches. He saw a yellow glow through the upper opening of the tree's stairwell, but the rope hauled him on upward into the heights of the village. His own movements made him swing slightly, so that at odd intervals he brushed against the leaves. But that was his only contact with the tree. He saw no lights, heard no voices. The deep black weights of the mighty limbs slid smoothly past him as if he were being dragged into the sky. Soon both his shoulders throbbed sharply and his arms went numb. With his head craned upward, he gaped into a lightless terror and moaned as if he were drowning, "Hellfire! Ah!" Then, without warning, his movement stopped. Before he could brace himself, a torch flared, and he found himself level with three men who were standing on a limb. In the sudden light, they looked identical to the men who had captured him, but one of them had a small circlet of leaves about his head. The other two considered Covenant for a moment, then reached out and gripped his shirt, pulling him toward their limb. As the solid branch struck his feet, the rope slackened, letting his arms drop. His wrists were still tied together, but he tried to get a hold on one of the men, keep himself from falling off the limb. His arms were dead. He could not move them. The darkness stretched below him like a hungry beast. With a gasp, he lunged toward the men, striving to make them save him. They grappled him roughly. He refused to bear his own weight, forced them to carry and drag him down the limb until they came to a wide gap in the trunk. There, the center of the stem was hollowed out to form a large chamber, and Covenant dropped heavily to the floor, shuddering with relief. Shortly, a rising current of activity began around him. He paid no attention to it. He kept his eyes shut to concentrate on the hard stability of the floor and on the pain of blood returning to his hands and arms. The hurt was excruciating, but he endured it in clenched silence. Soon his hands were tingling and his fingers felt thick, hot. He flexed them, curled them into claws. Through his teeth, he muttered to the fierce rhythm of his heart, "Hellfire, hell and blood." He opened his eyes. He was lying on polished wood at the center of the myriad concentric circles of the tree trunk. The age rings made the rest of the room seem to focus toward him as if he were sprawled on a target. His arms felt unnaturally inarticulate, but he forced them to thrust him into a sitting position. Then he looked at his hands. His wrists were raw from the cut of the rope, but they were not bleeding. "Bastards." He raised his head and glowered around him. The chamber was about 20 feet wide and seemed to fill the whole inside diameter of the trunk. The only opening was the one through which he had stumbled, and he could see darkness outside. But the room was brightly lit by torches set into the walls, torches which burned smokelessly and did not appear to be consumed. The polished walls gleamed as if they were burnished, but the ceiling, high above the floor, was rough, untouched wood. 5 wood Helvenin stood around Covenant in the hollow, 3 men, including the one wearing the circlet of leaves, and 2 women. They all were dressed in similar cloaks which clung to their outlines, though the colors varied, and all were taller than Covenant. Their tallness seemed threatening, so he got slowly to his feet, lowering the pack from his shoulders as he stood. A moment later, the man who had led Covenant's captors on the ground entered the chamber, followed by Atyarin. She appeared unharmed, but weary and depressed, as though the climb and the distrust had sapped her strength. When she saw Covenant, she moved to take her stand beside him. One of the women said, "Only 2, Sorinal." "Yes," Atyarin's guard answered. "We watched, and there were no others as they crossed the South Glade. And our scouts have not reported any other strangers in the hills." "Scouts?" asked Atyarin. "I did not know that scouts were needed among the people of the land." The woman took a step forward and replied, "Atyarin, trailmate, the folk of Middle Stone Down have been known to us since our return to the land in the New Age, and there are those among us who remember your visit here. We know our friends and the value of friendship." "And in what way have we deserved this treatment?" Atyarin demanded. "We came in search of friends." The woman did not answer Atyarin's question directly. "Because we are all people of the land," she said, "and because our peril is a peril for all, I will attempt to ease the sting of our discourtesy by explaining our actions. We in this Heartwood chamber are the heirs of Soaring Woodhelven, the leaders of our people. I am Laura, daughter of Anamar. Here also," she indicated each individual with a nod, "are O Mornal, daughter of Mornal, Sorinol, son of Thiller, Padrius, son of Mil, Maliner, son of Vaenin, and Baradacus, Hierbrand of the Lilianril. This last was the man wearing the circlet of leaves.
We made the decision of distrust, and will give our reasons.
I see that you are impatient. A taste of bitterness roughened her voice. Well, I will not tire you with the full tale of the blighting wind which has blown over us from time to time from Graven Threndor. I will not describe the angry storms, or show you the body of the three-winged bird that died atop our Woodhelven, or discuss the truth of the rumors of murder which have reached our ears. By the Seven, there are angry songs that should be sung, but I will not sing them now. This I will tell you. All servants of the Grey Slayer are not dead. It is our belief that a raver has been among us. That name carried a pang of danger that made Covenant look rapidly about him, trying to locate the peril. For an instant he did not comprehend, but then he noticed how Atiyaran stiffened at Laura's words, saw the jumping knot at the corner of her jaw, felt the heightened fear in her, though she said nothing, and he understood. The Woodhelvenin feared that he and she might be ravers. Without thinking, he snapped, "That's ridiculous." The hearers ignored him. After a short pause, Sorinol continued Laura's explanation. 2 days passed, in the high sun of afternoon, when our people were busy at their crafts and labors, and the children were playing in the upper branches of the tree. A stranger came to Soaring Woodhelven. 2 days earlier, the last ill storm out of Mount Thunder had broken suddenly and turned into good. And on the day the stranger came, our hearts were glad, thinking that a battle we knew not of had been won for the land. He wore the appearance of a stone downer and said his name was Jehanam. We welcomed him with the hospitality which is the joy of the land. We saw no reason to doubt him, though the children shrank from him with unwanted cries and fears. Alas for us! The young saw more clearly than the old. He passed among us with dark hints and spite in his mouth, casting sly ridicule on our crafts and customs, and we could not answer him. But we remembered peace and did nothing for a day. In that time, Jehanam's hints turned to open foretelling of doom. So at last we called him to the Heartwood Chamber and the meeting of the Hears. We heard the words he chose to speak, words full of glee and the reviling of the land. Then our eyes saw more deeply, and we offered him the test of the Lomelialor. You know of the High Wood, Lomelialor, do you not, Atiyaran? Baradacus spoke for the first time. There is much in it like the orc crest of the Rodamara. It is an offspring of the one tree from which the Staff of Law itself was made. But we had no chance to make the test, Sorinol resumed. When Jehanam saw the High Wood, he sprang away from us and escaped. We gave pursuit, but he had taken us by surprise. We were too full of quiet, not ready for such evils, and his fleetness far surpassed ours. He eluded us and made his way toward the east. He sighed as he concluded, "In the one day which has passed since that time, we have begun relearning the defense of the land." After a moment, Atiyaran said quietly, "I hear you. Pardon my anger. I spoke in haste and ignorance. But surely now you can see that we are no friends of the Grey Slayer." "We see much in you, Atiyaran, Trailmate," said Laura, her eyes fixed keenly on the stone downer. "Much sorrow and much courage. But your companion is closed to us. It may be that we will need to imprison this Thomas Covenant."
"Melancorian," hissed Atiyaran. "Do not dare. Do you not know? Have you not looked at him?"
At this, a murmur of relief passed among the hearers, a murmur which accented their tension. Stepping toward Atiyaran, Soranal extended his right hand, palm forward in the salute of welcome, and said, "We have looked and heard. We trust you, Atiyaran Trailmate. You have spoken a name which no raver would call upon to save a companion." He took her by the arm and drew her away from Covenant, out of the center of the chamber. Without her at his shoulder, Covenant felt suddenly exposed, vulnerable. For the first time, he sensed how much he had come to depend upon her presence, her guidance, if not her support. But he was in no mood to meet threats passively. He poised himself on the balls of his feet, ready to move in any direction, and his eyes shifted quickly among the faces that stared at him from the gleaming walls of the chamber. "Jehanam predicted many things," said Laura, "but one especially you should be told. He said that a great evil in the semblance of Beric Halfhand walked the hills toward us out of the south. And here," she pointed a pale arm at Covenant, her voice rising sternly as she spoke, "here is an utter stranger to the land, half unhanded on his right, and on his left bearing a ring of white gold, beyond doubt carrying messages to the lords, messages of doom." With a pleading intensity, Atiyaran said, "Do not presume to judge. Remember the oath. You are not lords, and dark words may be warnings as well as prophecies. Will you trust the word of a raver?" Baradakis shrugged slightly. "It is not the message we judge. Our test is for the man." Reaching behind him, he lifted up a smooth wooden rod 3 feet long from which all the bark had been stripped. He held it by the middle gently, reverently. "This is Lomalealor." As he said the name, the wood glistened as if its clear grain were moist with dew. "What the hell is this?" Covenant tried to balance himself for whatever was coming, but the higher brand's next move caught him by surprise. Baradakis swung his rod and lofted it toward the unbeliever. He jerked aside and clutched at the Lomalealor with his right hand, but he did not have enough fingers to get a quick grip on it. It slipped away from him, dropped to the floor with a wooden click that seemed unnaturally loud in the hush of the chamber. For an instant, everyone remained still, frozen while they absorbed the meaning of what they had seen. Then, in unison, the hearers uttered their verdict with all the finality of a death sentence. "The High Wood rejects him. He is a wrong in the land." Chapter 10, The Celebration of Spring. In one fluid motion, Baradakis drew a club from his cloak and raised it as he moved toward Covenant. Covenant reacted instinctively, defensively. Before the higher brand could reach him, he stooped and snatched up the Lomalealor rod with his left hand. As Baradakis swung the club at his head, he slashed the higher brand's arm with the rod. In a shower of white sparks, the club sprang into splinters. Baradakis was flung back as if he had been blasted away by an explosion. The force of the hit vibrated through Covenant's hand to his elbow, and his fingers were struck momentarily numb. The rod started to slip from his hand. He gaped at it, thinking, "What the hell?" But then the mute astonishment of the hearers and the higher brand's crumpled form steadied him. "Test me," he rasped. "Bastards." He took the rod in his right hand, holding it by the middle as Baradakis had done. Its glistening wood felt slick. It gave him a sensation of slippage, as if it were oozing from his grasp, though the wood did not actually move. As he gripped it, he glared around at the hearers, put all the anger their treatment had sparked in him into his gaze. "Now why don't you tell me one more time about how this thing rejects me?" Soranal and Laura stood on either side of Atiyaran, with Malinir opposite them against the wall. O'Mornal and Padrius were bent over the fallen Hierbrand. As Covenant surveyed them, Atiyaran faced him grimly.
In the older age, she said, when High Lord Kevin trusted the Grey Slayer, he was given priceless gifts of Orcrest and Lomelia lore. The tale says that these gifts were soon lost, but while the Grey Slayer possessed them, they did not reject him. It is possible for despite to wear the guise of truth. Perhaps the wild magic surpasses truth.
Thanks a lot. Covenant glowered at her. What are you trying to do to me? In a pale voice, Laura replied,
That is the tale. But we are only wood elven, not lords. Such matters are beyond us. Never in the memory of our people has a test of truth struck down a higher brand of the Lilianril. What is the song? He will save or damn the earth. Let us pray that we will not find damnation for our distrust.
Extending an unsteady hand toward Covenant in the salute of welcome, she said,
Hail, unbeliever. Pardon our doubts, and be welcome in Soaring Woodhelven.
For an instant, Covenant faced her with a bitter retort twisting his lips. But he found when he met her eyes that he could see the sincerity of her apology. The perception abashed his vehemence. With conflicting intentions, he muttered, Forget it. Laura and Soranal both bowed as if he had accepted her apology. Then they turned to watch as Baradakis climbed dazedly to his feet. His hands pulled at his face as if it were covered with cobwebs, but he assured O'Mornal and Padreus that he was unharmed. With a mixture of wonder and dismay in his eyes, he also saluted Covenant. Covenant responded with a dour nod. He did not wait for the higher brand to ask. He handed the Lomelia lore to Baradakis and was glad to be rid of its disquieting, insecure touch. Baradakis received the rod and smiled at it crookedly, as if it had witnessed his defeat. Then he slipped it away into his cloak. Turning his smile toward Covenant, he said,
Unbeliever, our presences are no longer needed here. You have not eaten, and the weariness of your journey lies heavily upon you. Will you accept the hospitality of my house?
The invitation surprised Covenant. For a moment he hesitated, trying to decide whether or not he could trust the higher brand. Baradakis appeared calm, unhostile, but his smile was more complex than Laura's apology. But then Covenant reflected that if the question were one of trust, he would be safer with Baradakis alone than with all the Heers together. Stiffly, he said, You honor me. The higher brand bowed.
In accepting a gift, you honor the giver.
He looked around at the other Woodhelvenin, and when they nodded their approval, he turned and moved out of the Heartwood Chamber. Covenant glanced toward Atiyaran, but she was already talking softly to Soranal. Without further delay, he stepped out onto the broad limb beside Baradakis. The night over the great tree was now scattered with lights, the home fires of the Woodhelvenin. They illuminated the fall far down through the branches, but did not reach to the ground. Involuntarily, Covenant clutched at Baradakis' shoulder.
It is not far, the higher brand said softly. Only up to the next limb. I will come behind you. You will not fall.
Cursing silently through his teeth, Covenant gripped the rungs of the ladder. He wanted to retreat, go back to the solidity of the Heartwood Chamber, but pride and anger prevented him, and the rungs felt secure, almost adhesive to his fingers. When Baradakis placed a reassuring hand on his back, he started awkwardly upward. As Baradakis had promised, the next limb was not far away. Soon, Covenant reached another broad branch. A few steps out from the trunk, it forked, and in the fork sat the higher brand's home. Holding Baradakis' shoulders for support, he gained the doorway, crossed the threshold as if he were being blown in by a gust of relief. He was in a neat, two-roomed dwelling formed entirely from the branches of the tree. Interwoven limbs made part of the floor and all the walls, including the partition between the rooms. And the ceiling was a dome of twigs and leaves. Along one wall of the first room, broad knees of wood grew into the chamber like chairs, and a bunk hung opposite them. The place had a warm, clean atmosphere, an ambiance of devotion to lore that Covenant found faintly disturbing, like a reminder that the higher brand could be a dangerous man. While Covenant scanned the room, Baradakis set torches in each of the outer walls and lit them by rubbing his hands over their ends and murmuring softly. Then he rummaged around in the far room for a moment and returned carrying a tray laden with slabs of bread and cheese, a large bunch of grapes, and a wooden jug. He set a small three-legged table between two of the chairs, put the tray on it, and motioned for Covenant to sit down. At the sight of the food, Covenant discovered that he was hungry. He had eaten nothing but Aliantha for the past 2 days. He watched while Baradakis bowed momentarily over the food. Then he seated himself. Following his host's example, he made sandwiches with cheese and grapes between slices of fresh bread and helped himself liberally to the jug of spring wine. In the first rush of eating, he said nothing, saving his attention for the food. But he did not forget who his host was, what had happened between them. Leaving the spring wine with Covenant, Baradakis cleared away the remains of the meal. When he returned after storing his food in the far room, he said, "Now, unbeliever, in what other way may I give you comfort?" Covenant took a deep draught of spring wine, then replied as casually as he could, "Give an answer. You were ready to split my head open back there. And it looked as if you got quite a jolt from that high wood. Why did you invite me here?" For a moment, Baradakis hesitated, as if pondering how much he should say. Then he reached into his back room, picked up a smooth staff nearly 6 feet long, and sat down on the bed across from Covenant. As he spoke, he began polishing the white wood of the staff with a soft cloth. "There are many reasons, Thomas Covenant. You required a place to sleep, and my home is nearer to the Heartwood Chamber than any other, for one who dislikes heights. And neither you nor I are necessary for the consideration of counsel and help which will be done this night. Atiaran knows the land. She will say all that need be said concerning your journey. And both Sorinal and Laura are able to give any help she may ask." As he looked across the room at the higher brand's working hands and light, penetrating eyes, Covenant had the odd feeling that his test had been resumed, that the encounter of the Loma Leolor had only begun Baradakis's examining. But the spring wine unknotted his fears and tensions. He was not anxious. Steadily, he said, "Tell me more." "I also intended that my offer of hospitality should be an apology. I was prepared to injure you, and that violation of my oath of peace needs reparation. Had you shown yourself to be a servant of the Grey Slayer, it would have sufficed to capture you, and injury might have deprived the lords of a chance to examine you. So in that way I was wrong, and became more wrong still when you lifted the Loma Leolor and its fire struck me. I hope to amend my folly." Covenant recognized the higher brand's frankness, but his sense of being probed sharpened rather than faded. He held his host's eyes as he said, "You still haven't answered my question." In an unsurprised tone, Baradakis countered, "Are there other reasons? What do you see in me?" "You're still testing me," Covenant growled. The higher brand nodded slowly. "Perhaps. Perhaps I am." He got to his feet and braced one end of the staff against the floor as he gave a last touch to its polish. Then he said, "See, Thomas Covenant, I have made a staff for you. When I began it, I believed it was for myself. But now I know otherwise. Take it. It may serve you when help and counsel fail." To the brief question in Covenant's eyes, he replied, "No, this is not high wood, but it is good nonetheless.
Let me give it to you.
Covenant shook his head. Finish your testing. Suddenly, Baradakis raised the staff and struck the wood under his feet a hard blow. For an instant, the entire limb shook as if a gale had come up. The smaller branches thrashed, and the dwelling tossed like a chip on an angry wave. Covenant feared that the tree was falling, and he gripped his chair in apprehension. But almost immediately, the violence passed. Baradakis leveled his pale eyes at Covenant and whispered, "Then hear me, unbeliever. Any test of truth is no greater than the one who gives it. And I have felt your power. In all the memory of the Lilianril, no higher brand has ever been struck by the High Wood. We are the friends of the One Tree, not its foes. But beside you, I am as weak as a child. I cannot force the truth from you. In spite of my testing, you might be the Grey Slayer himself, come to turn all the life of the land to ashes." Incensed by the suggestion, Covenant spat, "That's ridiculous." Baradakis stepped closer, drove his probing gaze deep into Covenant's eyes. Covenant squirmed. He could feel the higher brand exploring parts of him that he wanted to protect, keep hidden. "What has that bastard Fowl to do with me?" he demanded bitterly. "I didn't exactly choose to be his errand boy." Abruptly, Baradakis's eyes widened, and he fell back across the room as if he had seen something of astonishing power. He caught himself on the bed, sat there for a moment while he watched his hands tremble on the staff. Then he said carefully, "True. One day I may be wise enough to know what can be relied upon. Now I need time to understand. I trust you, my friend. At the last trial, you will not abandon us to death. Here." He proffered the staff again. "Will you not accept my gift?" Covenant did not reply at once. He was trembling also, and he had to clench himself before he could say without a tremor, "Why? Why do you trust me?" The higher brand's eyes gleamed as if he were on the verge of tears, but he was smiling as he said, "You are a man who knows the value of beauty." Covenant stared at that answer for a moment, then looked away. A complex shame came over him. He felt unclean, tainted in the face of Baradakis's trust. But then he stiffened. "Keep moving. Survive. What does trust have to do with it?" Brusquely, he reached out and accepted the staff. It felt pure in his hands, as if it had been shaped from the healthiest wood by the most loving devotion. He gripped it, scrutinized it, as if it could provide him with the innocence he lacked. A short time later, he surprised himself with a wide yawn. He had not realized that he was so tired. He tried to suppress his weariness, but the effort only produced another yawn. Baradakis responded with a kindly smile. He left the bed and motioned for Covenant to lie down. Covenant had no intention of going to sleep. But as soon as he was horizontal, all the spring wine he had consumed seemed to rush to his head, and he felt himself drifting on the high tree breeze. Soon, he was fast in slumber. He slept soundly, disturbed only by the memory of the higher brand's intense, questioning eyes, and by the sensation that the Loma Leolor was slipping through his fingers, no matter how hard he clenched it. When he awoke the next morning, his arms ached as if he had been grappling with an angel all night. Opening his eyes, he found Atiyaran sitting across the room from him, waiting. As soon as she saw that he was awake, she stood and moved closer to him. "Come, Thomas Covenant," she said. "Already we have lost the dawn of this day." Covenant studied her for a moment. The background of her face held a deepening shadow of fatigue, and he guessed that she had spent much of the night talking with the Hears. But she seemed somehow comforted by what she had shared and heard, and the brightness of her glance was almost optimistic. Perhaps she now had some sort of hope. He approved of anything that might reduce her hostility toward him, and he swung out of bed as if he shared her optimism. Despite the soreness of his arms, he felt remarkably refreshed, as if the ambiance of the Woodhelven had been exerting its hospitality, its beneficence, to help him rest. Moving briskly, he washed his face, dried himself on a thick towel of leaves, then checked himself for injuries and adjusted his clothing. A loaf lay on a three-legged table, and when he broke off a hunk for his breakfast, he found that it was made of bread and meat baked together. Munching it, he went to look out one of the windows. Atiaran joined him, and together they gazed through the branches northward. In the far distance, they saw a river running almost directly east, and beyond it the hills spread on to the horizon. But something more than the river separated these northern hills from those beside which the travelers had been walking since they had left Mithil Stonedown. The land beyond the river seemed a ripple in the morning sunshine, as if the quiet earth were flowing over shoals, as if there the secret rock of the land ruffled the surface, revealing itself to those who could read it. From his high Woodhelven vantage, Covenant felt he was seeing something that surpassed even his new perceptions.
"There," said Atiaran softly, as if she were speaking of a holy place. "There is Andalain. The Hierbrand has chosen his home well for such a view. Here the Mithil River runs east before turning north again toward Graven Threndor and the Soul's Ease. And beyond are the Andalanian Hills, the heart-healing richness of the land. Ah, Covenant, the seeing of them gives me courage. And Sorinol has taught me a path which may make possible my fondest dream. With good fortune and good speed, we may see that which will turn much of my folly to wisdom. We must go. Are you prepared?"
No, Covenant thought. Not to go climbing around this tree. But he nodded. Atiaran had brought his pack to him, and while she stepped out of the Hierbrand's home onto the broad branch, he pulled the straps onto his shoulders, ignoring the ache of his arms. Then he took up the staff Baradakas had given him and braced himself to risk his neck on the descent of the Woodhelven. The trunk was only 3 or 4 steps away, but the 200-foot drop to the ground made him freeze, hesitate apprehensively while the first reels of vertigo gnawed at his resolve. But as he stood in the Hierbrand's doorway, he heard the shouting of young voices and saw children scampering through the branches overhead. Some of them pursued others, and in the chase they sprang from limb to limb as blithely as if the fall were helpless to hurt them. The next instant, 2 children, a boy and a girl, dropped onto the limb before Covenant from a branch nearly 20 feet above. The girl was in merry pursuit of the boy, but he eluded her touch and darted around behind Covenant. From this covert he shouted gleefully, "Safe! Chase another! I am safe!" Without thinking, Covenant said, "He's safe." The girl laughed, faked a lunge forward, and sprang away after someone else. At once, the boy dashed to the trunk and scurried up the ladder toward higher playgrounds. Covenant took a deep breath, clutched the staff for balance, and stepped away from the door. Teetering awkwardly, he struggled to the relative safety of the trunk. After that, he felt better. When he slid the staff through his pack straps, he could grip the ladder with both hands, and then the secure touch of the rungs reassured him. Before he had covered half the distance, his heart was no longer pounding, and he was able to trust his hold enough to look about him at the dwellings and people he passed. Finally, he reached the lowest branches and followed Atiaran down the stair to the ground. There the Hears were gathered to say their farewells. When he saw Baradakas, Covenant took the staff in his hands to show that he had not forgotten it, and grimaced in response to the Hierbrand's smile.
"Well, message-bearers," said Laura after a pause, "you have told us that the fate of the land is on your shoulders, and we believe. It sorrows us that we cannot ease the burden, but we judge that no one can take your place in this matter. What little help we can give, we have given. All which remains for us is to defend our homes and to pray for you. We wish you good speed for the sake of all the land. And for your own sake, we urge you to be in time for the celebration. There are great omens of hope for any who view that festival. Atiaran Trellmate, go in peace and fealty. Remember the path Soranal taught you, and do not turn aside. Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and stranger to the land, be true. In the hour of darkness, remember the higher brand's staff. Now be on your way.
Atiaran replied as formally as if she were completing a ritual. We go, remembering Soaring Woodhelven for home and help and hope. She bowed, touching her palms to her forehead and then spreading her arms wide. Uncertainly, Covenant followed her example. The Hears returned the heart-opening gesture of farewell with ceremonial deliberateness. Then Atiaran strode off northward, and Covenant scudded along behind her like a leaf in the wake of her determination. Neither of them looked back. The rest and restoration of the fair tree village made them brisk, gave them a forward air. They were both in their separate ways eager for Andalane, and they knew that Jehanum had left Soaring Woodhelven toward the east, not the north. They hastened ahead among the richening hills and reached the banks of the Middle River early that afternoon. They crossed by wading a wide shallows. Before she entered the water, Atiaran removed her sandals, and some half-conscious insight urged Covenant to take off his boots and socks, roll up his pant legs. As he smelled the first lush scents of the hills, he felt somehow that he needed to wade the Middle barefoot in order to be ready, that the foot washing of the stream was necessary to transubstantiate his flesh into the keener essence of Andalane. And when he stepped onto the north bank, he found that he could feel its vitality through his feet. Now even his soles were sensitive to the land's health. He so liked the strong sensation of the hills under his toes that he was loath to put his boots back on, but he denied himself that pleasure so that he would be able to keep up with Atiaran's pace. Then he followed her along the path which Soranal had taught her, an easy way through the center of Andalane, walked and wondered at the change that had come over the earth since they had crossed the river. He felt the change distinctly, but it seemed to go beyond the details which composed it. The trees were generally taller and broader than their southern relations. Abundant and prodigal Aliantha sometimes covered whole hillsides with viridian. The rises and vales luxuriated in deep aromatic grass. Flowers bobbed in the breeze as spontaneously as if just moments before they had gaily burst from the nurture of the soil. Small woodland animals, rabbits, squirrels, badgers, and the like, scampered around, only vaguely remembering that they were wary of humans. But the real difference was transcendent. The Andalanian hills carried a purer impression of health to all Covenant senses than anything else he had experienced. The aura of rightness here was so powerful that he began to regret he belonged in a world where health was impalpable, indefinite, discernible only by implication. For a time, he wondered how he would be able to endure going back, waking up. But the beauty of Andalane soon made him forget such concerns. It was a dangerous loveliness, not because it was treacherous or harmful, but because it could seduce. Before long, disease, VSE, despite, anger, all were forgotten, lost in the flow of health from one vista to another around him. Enclosed in the hills, surrounded by such tangible and specific vitality, he became more and more surprised that Atiaran did not wish to linger. As they hiked over the lambent terrain, penetrating league after league deeper into Andalane, he wanted to stop at each new revelation, each new valley or avenue or dale, to savor what he saw, grip it with his eyes until it was a part of him, indelible, secure against any coming bereavement. But Atiaran pushed on, arising early, stopping little, hurrying late. Her eyes were focused far away, and the fatigue mounting behind her features seemed unable to reach the surface. Clearly, even these hills paled for her beside her anticipation of the unexplained celebration. Covenant had no choice but to urge himself after her. Her will tolerated no delay. Their second night away from Soaring Woodhelven was so bright and clear that they did not have to stop with the setting of the sun, and Atiaren kept going until nearly midnight. After supper, Covenant sat for a while looking at the sky and the piquant stars. The aging crescent of the moon stood high in the heavens, and its white sliver sent down only a suggestion of the eldritch light which had illuminated his first night in the land. Casually, he remarked, "The moon will be dark in a few days." At that, Atiaren looked at him sharply, as if she suspected that he had discovered some secret of hers. But she said nothing, and he did not know whether she reacted to a memory or to an anticipation. The next day began as splendidly as the previous one. Sunshine begemmed the dew, sparkled like diamonds among the grass and leaves. Air as fresh as the earth's first breath carried the tang of alyantha and larch, the fragrance of guilden and peony across the hills. Covenant beheld such things with something like bliss in his heart and followed Atiaren northward as if he were content. But early in the afternoon something happened which darkened all his joy, offended him to the marrow of his bones. As he traveled down a natural lane between tree-thick hills, walking with a fine sense of the springy grass under his feet, he stepped without warning on a patch of turf that felt as dangerous as a pit of quicksand. Instinctively, he recoiled, jerked back 3 steps. At once, the threatening sensation vanished, but his nerves remembered it from the sole of his foot up the whole length of his leg. He was so surprised, so insulted, that he did not think to call Atiaren. Instead, he cautiously approached the spot on which he had felt the danger and touched it with one tentative toe. This time, however, he felt nothing but the lush grass of Andalane. Bending down, he went over the grass for a yard in all directions with his hands. But whatever had fired his sense of wrongness was gone now, and after a moment of perplexity, he started forward again. At first, he took each step gingerly, expecting another jolt. But the earth seemed as full of pure, resonant vitality as before. Shortly, he broke into a trot to catch up with Atiaren. Toward evening, he felt the sting of wrong again, as if he had stepped in acid. This time, he reacted in violent revulsion. He pitched forward as if diving away from a blast of lightning, and a yell ripped past his teeth before he could stop himself. Atiaren came back to him at a run and found him pawing over the grass, tearing up the blades in handfuls of outrage. "Here," he gritted, thumping the turf with his fist. "By hell, it was here." Atiaren blinked at him blankly. He jumped to his feet, pointed an accusing finger at the ground. "Didn't you feel it? It was there. Hellfire." His finger quivered. "How did you miss it?" "I felt nothing," she replied evenly. He shuddered and dropped his hand. "It felt as if I stepped in quicksand, or acid, or," he remembered the slain way in him, "or murder." Slowly, Atiaren knelt beside the spot he indicated. For a moment, she studied it, then touched it with her hands. When she stood up, she said, "I feel nothing." "It's gone," he interrupted. "But I have not the touch of a Rademarl," she went on. "Have you felt this before?"
"Once. Earlier."
"Ah," she sighed. "Would that I were a lord and knew what to do. There must be an evil working deep in the earth. A great evil indeed, if the Andalanian hills are not altogether safe. But the ill is new yet, or timid. It does not remain. We must hope to outrun it. Ah, weak. Our speed becomes less sufficient with each passing day." She pulled her robe tightly about her, strode away into the evening. She and Covenant traveled on without a halt until night was thick around them and the waning moon was high in its path among the stars. The next day, Covenant felt convulsions of ill through the grass more often. Twice during the morning and four times during the afternoon and evening, one foot or the other recoiled with sudden ferocity from the turf, and by the time Atiyaran stopped for the night, his nerves from his legs to the roots of his teeth were raw and jangling. He felt intensely that such sore spots were an affront to, even a betrayal of Andalane, where every other touch and line and hue of sky and tree and grass and hill was redolent with richness. Those attacks, pangs, stings made him involuntarily wary of the ground itself, as if the very foundation of the earth had been cast into doubt. On the fifth day since soaring Woodhelven, he felt the wrongness in the grass less often, but the attacks showed an increase in virulence. Shortly after noon, he found a spot of ill that did not vanish after he first touched it. When he set his foot on it again, he felt a quiver as if he had stepped on an ache in the ground. The vibration rapidly numbed his foot, and his jaws hurt from clenching his teeth, but he did not back away. Calling to Atiyaran, he knelt on the grass and touched the earth's sore with his hands. To his surprise, he felt nothing. Atiyaran explored the ground herself, then considered him with a frown in her eyes. She also felt nothing. But when he probed the spot with his foot, he found that the pain was still there. It scraped his brain, made sweat bead on his forehead, drew a snarl from his throat. As the ache spread through his bones, sending cold numbness up his leg, he bent to slide his fingers under the sole of his boot. But his hands still felt nothing. Only his feet were sensitive to the peril. On an impulse, he threw off one boot, removed his sock, and placed his bare foot on the spot of ill. This time, the discrepancy was even more surprising. He could feel the pain with his booted foot, but not with his bare one. And yet his sensations were perfectly clear. The wrong arose from the ground, not from his boot. Before he could stop himself, he snatched off his other boot and sock and cast them away from him. Then he dropped heavily to sit on the grass and clutched his throbbing head in both hands. "I have no sandals for you," Atiyaran said stiffly. "You will need footwear before this journey has reached its end." Covenant hardly heard her. He felt acutely that he had recognized a danger, identified a threat which had been warping him for days without his knowledge. "Is that how you're going to do it, Fowl?" he snarled. "First my nerves come back to life. Then Andalane makes me forget. Then I throw away my boots. Is that it? Break down all my defenses one at a time so that I won't be able to protect myself? Is that how you're going to destroy me?" "We must go on," Atiyaran said. "Decide what you will do." "Decide? Bloody hell." Covenant jerked himself to his feet. Fuming, he grated through his teeth. "It's not that easy." Then he stalked over to retrieve his boots and socks. "Survive." He laced his feet into his boots as if they were a kind of armor. For the rest of the day, he shied away from every hint of pain in the ground and followed Atiyaran grimly, with a clenched look in his eyes, striving against the stinging wrong to preserve his sovereignty, his sense of himself. And toward evening, his struggle seemed to find success. After a particularly vicious attack late in the afternoon, the ill pangs stopped. He did not know whether or not they would return, but for a while at least, he was free of them. That night was dark with clouds, and Atiyaran was forced to make camp earlier than usual. Yet she and Covenant got little rest. A light, steady rain soaked their blankets and kept them awake most of the night, huddling for shelter under the deeper shadow of an enshrouding willow. But the next morning, the sixth of their journey from Soaring Woodhelven, dawned bright and full of Andalanian cheer. Atiyaran met it with haste and anticipation in her every move. and the way she urged Covenant along seemed to express more friendliness, more companionship than anything she had done since the beginning of their sojourn. Her desire for speed was infectious. Covenant was glad to share it because it rescued him from thinking about the possibility of further attacks of wrong. They began the day's travel at a lope. The day was made for traveling. The air was cool, the sun clean and encouraging. The path led straight and level. Springy grass carried Atiyaran and Covenant forward at every stride, and her contagious eagerness kept him trotting behind her league after league. Toward midday, she slowed her pace to eat treasure berries along the way. But even then she made good speed, and as evening neared, she pushed their pace into a lope again. Then the untracked path which the Wood Helvenin had taught her brought them to the end of a broad valley. After a brief halt while she verified her bearings, she started straight up a long, slow hillside that seemed to carry on away eastward for a great distance. She chose a plumb-line direction which took her directly between two matched guilden trees 100 yards above the valley, and Covenant followed her toiling lope up the hill without question. He was too tired and out of breath to ask questions. So they ascended that hillside, Atiyaran trotting upward with her head held high and her hair fluttering as if she saw fixed before her the starry gates of heaven, and Covenant plodding, pumping behind her. At their backs, the sun sank in a deep exhalation like the release of a long-pent sigh, and ahead of them, the slope seemed to stretch on into the sky. Covenant was dumbfounded when Atiyaran reached the crest of the hill, stopped abruptly, grabbed his shoulders, and spun him around in a circle, crying joyfully, "We are here! We are in time!" He lost his balance and fell to the turf. For a moment he lay panting, with hardly enough energy to stare at her. But she was not aware of him. Her eyes were fixed down the eastern slope of the hill as she called in a voice short-breathed by fatigue and exultation and reverence, "Banas Nimaram! Ah, oh, glad heart of Andalane! I have lived to this time." Caught by the witchery of her voice, Covenant levered himself to his feet and followed her gaze as if he expected to behold the soul of Andalane incarnate. He could not refrain from groaning in the first sag of his disappointment. He could see nothing to account for Atiyaran's rapture, nothing that was more healthy or precious than the myriad vistas of Andalane past which she had rushed unheeding. Below him, the grass dipped into a smooth, wide bowl set into the hills like a drinking cup for the night sky. With the sun gone, the outlines of the bowl were not clear, but starlight was enough to show that there were no trees, no bushes, no interruptions to the smoothness of the bowl. It looked as regular as if the surface of the grass had been sanded and burnished. On this night, the stars seemed especially gay, as if the darkness of the moon challenged them to new brightness. But Covenant felt that such things were not enough to reward his bone-deep fatigue. However, Atiyaran did not ignore his groan. Taking his arm, she said, "Do not judge me yet," and drew him forward. Under the branches of the last tree on the bowl's lip, she dropped her pack and sat against the trunk, facing down the hill. When Covenant had joined her, she said softly, "Control your mad heart, unbeliever. We are here in time. This is Banas Nimaram, the dark of the moon on the middle night of spring. Not in my generation has there been such a night, such a time of rareness and beauty. Do not measure the land by the standard of yourself. Wait. This is Banas Nimaram, the celebration of spring, finest rite of all the treasures of the earth. If you do not disturb the air with anger, we will see the dance of the wraiths of Andalane." As she spoke, her voice echoed with rich harmonics as if she were singing, and Covenant felt the force of what she promised, though he did not understand. It was not a time for questions, and he set himself to wait for the visitation. Waiting was not difficult. First, Atiyaran passed bread and the last of her spring wine to him, and eating and drinking eased some of his weariness. Then, as the night deepened, he found that the air which flowed up to them from the bowl had a lush, restful effect.